said, as a boy, I used to read his articles, but it hasn't been that long ago. As a young man, I used to do that. Michael has been in the journalism field for a long time and still is in a very important way as a professor at Huxley College, connected with the Western Washington University. His career includes credits as far as writing his newspapers, travel editors. He was with the American Forest magazine, Field and Stream magazine. He's been associated with a number of educational institutions. I told him we ought to have a contest here. Who knows where Northland College is located? I bet Janet Anderson Tyler does, but okay. See me later. We'll see if you have the right answer. He's also been associated with the University of Idaho, and most recently, currently since 1987, Huxley College. I asked him about introduction. He said, make it short. So with that short introduction, I present Michael Frohm.
You may applaud any time. It'll help keep you warm. In fact, I think my main function this evening is to heat things up, but I won't say anything nasty or provocative at this, unless you get me into it. I'm not going to talk about the assigned topic, which was the legislative history, unless you ask me about it. Otherwise, we can read about it in a book sometime. But I'm reminded of, in 1974, I went down to speak at the dedication of the Sipsey Wilderness in Alabama, which the citizen, which it's a warm state, and that might help to generate some heat. And the Sipsey Wilderness was brought into being through the efforts of the good people of Alabama, through the Alabama Conservancy. And we had a typical Southern reception with a lot of goodwill, and I had recently written a book, Battle for the Wilderness, and I was signing copies of my book. And a young woman was, she thought I was a celebrity or something, and she kept hanging around me. And I said, now, okay, I've got to prepare my comments, so please go away. And she said, no, you don't have to prepare your comments. Speak from the heart, and you'll do fine. And you know, she was right. There's nothing like speaking from the heart. It isn't the easiest thing to do, but it's the most rewarding. It's what I try to do, and it's what I try to teach my students. I tell them, right from the heart. In all of my academic career, which is now 10 or 12 years old, I keep getting in trouble with that kind of thing. Because what the professors say is, you must be objective. And I'm not objective. When I was at the university, and I listened to God, God gives seasons for gladness of heart. God wants me to speak from the heart, and he wants me to ask you to open up your hearts as we go into this dialogue about wilderness values. When I was at the University of Idaho, I was invited to give a guest lecture in a class on conservation for non-majors. And before I went into the class, I was given the curriculum for the course, and right at the top it said, this is objective. No subjective views are allowed. So I came into the class and I said, this will be different. It will be subjective. And I did something like we did last evening. I did a little visualization. I would have done it tonight if he hadn't done it yesterday. I said, breathe deeply, close your eyes, and get a picture of wilderness and write about it. And it was so wonderful to let people open up and communicate from the heart. I do want to discuss, direct my attention to the overall objectives. One, to strengthen understanding of wilderness values and concepts. Two, to enhance line and staff knowledge of current resource and management issues affecting wilderness I made 4 out of the 3. 3, increased line officer and staff understanding of their responsibilities in wilderness management. And 4, build commitment for assuming a leadership role. I don't want to talk about institutions or the Forest Service. I want to talk about people. In 1971, I wrote a book called The Forest Service. It was part of a series about government agencies and departments. And in 1984, a new edition came out. And I see that in the preface I wrote as follows. What this book is about, or what I hope it deals with more extensively and effectively in this new and expanding edition than the original of a decade ago, is people. The fate of our forests, after all, rests with people. Laws don't make things work, nor do rules and regulations. They have their place, but it takes the human hand, heart, and mind to give them meaning, whether for better or for worse. It strikes me today that the Forest Service as an institution is what its people, from top to bottom, make of it. More important, they are what they make of themselves. I'm concerned about the forester or forest conservationist as an individual, about his or her motivation and philosophy. Working within a large structure can be difficult and at times discouraging. But those who are rooted with sound outlook will persevere, and I hope, without perishing. While I have the book, I want to make a couple of other citations. I was reminded of something yesterday when Wendy came up to me and she said, "You put my name in one of your books." And I said, "Which book was it?" She said, and she reminded me that it was this one. I had a chapter about opening for opportunity and constituency. And I quoted from Jetty B. Wild Jr., who's probably gone from the scene now, but he was Director of Civil Rights from the Forest Service in 1981. And he said as follows, "We want to develop all our employees and provide equal access for all Americans. Promoting equal opportunity in employment and services is good management and sound social policy. Putting people productively to work and helping them to realize their potential benefits, benefits them as individuals and the nation as well." And I think that's what John Hendy was talking about today. Now, what I had in my chapter here was equalizing the opportunity. And I wrote about women. And I wrote about Wendy L. Milner, who was appointed in 1971 as the first woman district ranger in Forest Service history. There weren't any before, and that was in 1979. There weren't any before then. Before then, the only women in the Forest Service were wives and secretaries. When I was at the University of Idaho in 1983 or 84 or 85, the supervisors of Region 1 came to meet at Moscow, and they invited various members of the faculty to speak to them on different subjects. And I was invited to speak to them on wilderness. And here they were, sitting on a rectangular table, the forest supervisors and the supernumeraries from the region. There were about 30 or 40 men and one woman, Barbara Holder, who you may know. And a student of mine came in. She was interested in wilderness, and she wanted to hear what I had to say, Diane, and she sat in the back of the room. I said, "Come on, Diane, sit up with all of these he-men and keep Barbara company." And you know, I thought at that time, and they all bristled. I thought at that time that these men, they knew they had to accept women as their peers, but they didn't understand why. And I've talked to women and related with women, And I'll tell you, a lot of the men still don't know why. Do they? And I see some of the women nodding their heads. In 1990, I went to be at the centennial of Yosemite National Park out in California, and I was on a panel. There was a really nice crowd out front, and on the panel, I was one of nine men, mostly old men. And the crowd was full of women. It just didn't make a damn bit of sense, did it? And it still doesn't. So, you know, Sue, you talked yesterday about, we can talk about these things now about wilderness, and we can talk about women. And we can listen to women. Women can speak and be heard. Now, some of, I think it might even be you, Sue. One of the women said today when John Hendy was speaking, next year, why don't we reach out to minority groups as our clients and have them come into the wilderness too? Why didn't somebody say, I'll say it now. Why don't next year we have some blacks here in this group and some Hispanics and some Native Americans? I mean, if we're really going to do it right. And some Asians, Asian Americans. So, you know, a lot of progress has been made and points for progress. But the wonderful thing about noting progress is we can also say, we got a long, long way to go, if you don't mind my saying so. And even if you do mind my saying so. So what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about values, and then I want to say let's have some discussion about that. And then I want to go on and talk about knowledge of current resource and management issues. And understanding of responsibilities, if it's okay with you. So I'm going to read you a little essay of mine that I happen to write for one of our publications. We have a weekly newsletter at Huxley College of Environmental Studies at Western Washington University, where I have successfully posed as a professor for 6 years. And one of my colleagues, for whom I have the greatest respect, took the position that the only way to make environmental progress is by making it economically or commercially or financially attractive and feasible. He said, ethics don't count. And this disturbed some of the students. And so he and I had a little debate in print, and this is what I wrote. When Pope John Paul II came to America a few years ago, he said, we need more than social reformers. Come in. We need saints. And I say, yes, we need to elevate the spirit of ethical caring and sharing, of giving rather than taking, of daring to stand alone, out front, powered by the idea that the great use of a life is to create something that outlasts it. Or to put it another way, true success comes only from within. The movers and shakers who conceived and crusaded for the Monumental Wilderness Act of 1964 were that kind of people. Howard Zonheiser, the principal architect of the act, was an example. I knew him as studious, gentle, articulate, and compassionate, a visionary creating reality out of a dream and never losing heart. We are not fighting progress, he would say. We are making it. We are not dealing with the vanishing wilderness. We are working for a wilderness forever. He and others proved more than 25 years ago that it can be done. And in more recent times, on the world front, it's been proven anew. when the Berlin Wall came down, when the Soviet Union collapsed, when apartheid came to an end in South Africa, when Israel and the Palestinians signed a peace treaty, they demonstrated that the rules of yesterday need not be the rules for tomorrow. Yes, we need more than social reform. We need to press society to reorder its priorities, to effect a course correction in international goals based on elimination of waste and overconsumption, a dependence on wars, toxic chemicals, and the unrestrained drive for material wealth. Individuals can and do work miracles. It's just wonderful. As opposed to old guard institutions and professions that breed conformity and compliance. Albert Einstein said that imagination is more important than knowledge, to which I would add that feeling is more important than fact, particularly considering that yesterday's fact sometimes becomes tomorrow's fiction. To say it another way, while recognizing the value of economics, science, and all the practical tools of society, the source of strength in human life is in emotion. Reverence and passion for the earth and for its larger web of life. Of all the tools that we humans have to work with, emotion is the strongest. And of all emotions, love is the strongest. I conceive the world in terms of poetry, as well as science. I endeavor to go beyond convention, to know myself as part of a universe, shaped as spirit, as well as matter. And who can deny that when we go into the wilderness? Not the matter that counts, it's the spirit. I can make a long speech about spirituality because it's just a word. But when I go in the wilderness, what makes it so magical is the connection with the higher power. Whether you want to call it God or a higher power, or whatever it may be. You know, there's really no right and no wrong. We can have a lot of arguments. I don't know, we can discuss political issues or forest issues. Now, I can presume to be right, but I know in my heart I'm not right, because the only right is divine right. And none of us is privy to that. So it's great to go to the wilderness to search for the connection with some force that's so much bigger than ourselves. This is not to deny the value and need of mechanics or of technology, but a philosophy must provide the foundation for them, a philosophy of concern and compassion. So I see a new kind of science in the sense of being. Albert Schweitzer espoused the reverence for life. Humankind is ethical when life becomes sacred to man or woman, Schweitzer taught, and not simply one's own life, but that of all humans and of plants and animals. And when a human devotes himself or herself to other living things. They don't teach that in management. They just don't teach that in management. I'm not much for management, sorry. I'm not much for using the word resource either. Reducing God's earth to a commodity. I just can't do that. this generation could clean up the Columbia River or the Mississippi River for our own purposes. Without, however, understanding the true role of the river as a living symbol of all the life it sustains and nourishes and our responsibilities to it, we would merely be balancing the cost benefits of using the river one way against the cost benefits of using it another. I hearken to the lesson of Emerson that literature, poetry, and science all are homage of humankind to the unfathomed secrets of nature. That all things are friendly and sacred, all days holy, all beings divine. That every chemical substance, every animal in its growth teaches unity of cause. Thus I respect the river for its own sake. We live in a very strange time, marked by anguish and despair. Yet personal illumination and redemption are available to any individual who is attentive, with open eyes, and who responds with caring and giving from an open heart. If 1,000 years from today, the earth, waters, and skies of our little planet are in better condition than they are today, come in. It will be because the people cared enough to save them, cared enough even in the face of other potential uses. The long-term success depends on appreciation of the value of our natural heritage and the willingness to proclaim that we are indeed a moral and ethical species. Now, I want to take a break there, and I want to see, you know, one thing I learned about teaching is the worst form of teaching is the lecture. And the worst form of communication is the speech. So I want to see if we can have a little, if you have some thoughts about what I've said up to this point. Yes. Go ahead. Go ahead.
We want to comment about the don't want to use the word resource.
Yeah.
I complain about that on myself.
Good. Well, does anybody else want to talk about that? What? Where are you? Yeah. I'll go for that. Go ahead.
Someone mentioned that
Well, I have to tell you, I got energetic, you know. I believe in this, and I got a great I got a great line from Tom Kovalicki with whom I spent some time when I was in Idaho and he was in Idaho, and I went out with him and interviewed him, and I put it in a book, my interview with him. He said, "Wilderness is my life." That's what he said, and wilderness is my life. So I decided I was going to get some credibility, and I decided I wanted to be a PhD, and I did do that. And my dissertation was about wilderness preservation, public support of wilderness values in science, wildlife, and sacred space. And I had four connected essays, one on science, one on wildlife, one on sacred space, and one on making wilderness work, which is how the citizens have made wilderness work. But I learned so much in my study of sacred space. And you're absolutely right. When God made the earth, he didn't say, "I love one piece of it more than another." Or she didn't say that. You know, it's all sacred. And wilderness, it's a state of mind. Wilderness is what you want it to be, or what I want it to be in my own head. But it's nice to know that it's out there somewhere, in fact. And it can be very small, and it can be very large in a big ecosystem. So... now, I want to get some more discussion out of you, so I'll pay you all a compliment on values. I have met wonderful people in the Forest Service, and I owe a lot to them for who I am and where I am. And one of the nicest people I met was one of the chiefs, Richard McArdle. And I'm sure he's before most of your time. But he said like so, "I was determined to broaden the horizons of Forest Service people. I thought we were too hidebound, that we didn't have broad viewpoints, and we were so wrapped up with our own agency, we couldn't see what other people were doing. I don't know whether I succeeded, but I tried," and he did. But to go on from him, "I was trying to avoid the penalties of bigness. When an organization gets big, we lose the sense of service." Isn't that true? I mean, it's not only the Forest Service, any organization. His last sentence, "People who never looked at the clock stopped at 8 hours. Now, the compliment that I want to pay is that, and I'm going to get to speak again later in evaluating the whole program, but the compliment that I want to pay is I don't feel I'm with people here who look at the clock and stop at 8 hours. I think you're people, I'm with people who are caring and committed and love their work, and, you know, I love my work too, and it's sort of... almost indecent to take money for what we're doing here, isn't it? I mean, for being in this glorious setting and for talking about something we all care about. So, having paid a compliment, I wish I could hear some more discussion about values. That's great.
great. Okay, now she shook her head.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead. Why don't you stand up? Go ahead, John. Go ahead. Good job. Well, I think everybody's right. Okay.
I want to know, why is Sam Hill even insisting us talking about values? Don't you realize that values are going to make this harder for each other?
Good. Good. Well, I'm going to make a few final comments on this and then go on to something else. Joe reminded me of I was in New York City. This was 15 years or so ago, and I wrote it in a book. I was on my way to the airport, and I got stuck in traffic and with this cab driver, and he didn't know who I was or what my interest was, and we're stuck in traffic I'm trying desperately to catch an airplane, and he starts telling me about the wilderness areas he's seen on television, the Everglades and all these other, and Yellowstone, and I made the plane. I said if you get me to the plane on time, I'll give you an extra tip. He says, as long as we keep moving, we'll get there, and we did get there. But all the time he's telling me about these adventures that he's going through and of things he's seen and read about. It was so beautiful. That's one comment I want to make. The other comment I want to make is everybody comes in somewhere, you know? Everybody comes in somewhere. The person who says, my wilderness is Central Park, that's his wilderness. Or her wilderness, that's his or her wilderness. I've seen people who go down the Colorado River on power-driven boats. That's their starting point, and it changes their lives. And then I myself was a travel writer. And in 1959, my beloved mentor, Clint Davis, I don't know whether anybody here goes back that far, when they had a real I&E program in the Forest Service, he was the chief of I&E. And he took me on a wilderness trip in the Bridge of Wilderness, and it absolutely changed my life. And I said, gee, if this is multiple use, I'm all for it. I want to be on this team. Then later I became disenchanted for reasons that I don't want to need to go into. But everybody comes in somewhere. And as I quoted, you know, what we need is we don't need reformers, we need saints. We need missionaries who are selfless, who care about people and care about God's earth, who want to be real stewards. So that's what I want to say about values. Now I want to read you a couple of letters that I wrote, one to the chief and one
and I'll read it to you. This was July 10. I want to get into the other subject of knowledge of current resource and management issues. July 10, 1992. Dear Dale, I have at hand copy of your congressional testimony of June 23 concerning H.R. 4325, the National Forest Wilderness Management Act. Portions appear quite encouraging, and I would like to follow up with a few questions and comments for you and or your associates directly involved in issues of wilderness management. That's you. For example, in the second paragraph of the testimony, you report that the Forest Service is, quote, already implementing many actions parallel to those directed in the bill, unquote. While that certainly is promising, it would be helpful if you would spell out those actions already taken. In the third paragraph, you advise that wilderness is a major priority for the Forest Service, unquote. That is very heartening. I'm glad to observe you as chief declare this new emphasis considering the chronic lack of attention to wilderness at all levels of the agency. I look forward to public declarations from you on the specifics to fully realize this major priority. I note your reference to wilderness pioneers Alder Leopold, Bob Marshall, and Arthur Carhart, two of whom left the Forest Service and one of whom died at an early age. How about public recognition for those in the ranks who champion wilderness in more recent times, sometimes with great difficulty? Individuals like Bill Wharf, John Herbert, Tom Kovalicki, and Paul Weingart. You know those people. You refer to crown jewels of the wilderness system, citing specifically the Bob Marshall, Maroon Bells, Snowmass, Gila, Teton, John Muir, Mount Hood, Shining Rocks, Boundary Waters, Canoe Area, and the Frank Church River, No Return. But are they really administered as crown jewels? And I ask you that question. At the first National Wilderness Management Workshop in 1983, I declared that, and I quote, I've been to as many wilderness areas as anyone, but I haven't seen a single wilderness anywhere in this country being managed as it should be, in fulfillment of the letter and spirit of the Wilderness Act, unquote. Thus, I feel it fair to ask about definitive actions already taken or being taken to deal with management weaknesses and deficiencies in those crown jewels to which you refer in your testimony. I applaud your report to Congress that all regional foresters and line officers are now evaluated for their performance in wilderness management, including wilderness program goals, wilderness planning, and accountability for wilderness funds. That is good news. It is good news, too, that the agency seeks to improve the management of wilderness and special management areas. How is this commitment being applied to Hell's Canyon National Recreation Area, a special management area in particular need of improved management? I applaud also your stated determination to strengthen the leadership role by forming an internal National Wilderness Council to help overcome the perception of wilderness as recreation only and to assure a sound ecological approach. Who, may I inquire, are the personnel members of this council? How and well will the council provide data to the public? What access to the council will you provide to the public? In the same paragraph, you mentioned that such wilderness councils already are functioning in some regional offices. In which regions are such councils located? How do they relate to the public? I was especially pleased to note your intent to, quote, focus more effort on addressing the ecological health of wilderness areas and determining whether the ecological health is improving or deteriorating, unquote. I will look forward to this assessment objectively undertaken. Where in the hell is it? I hope also the agency at all levels will undertake to improve communication with the public on wilderness issues. I received a copy of your statement through circuitous channels, though I'm sure you agree that such an important pronouncement merits wide dissemination. 6 months later, I received an acknowledgement from the so-called Wilderness Office in the Washington office, Twist and Jerry Stokes, is that right? Saying, please forgive us, we've been busy and we haven't been able to get around to answering your question. And what the hell's going on? How serious are we? I wrote another letter on August. I never got a letter from the chief, but that's all right. I didn't expect one, but I should have gotten serious. I thought I should have gotten some attention from somebody. If you're serious, if Robertson is serious, Here's a letter I wrote to Floyd J. Marita, regional forester, Wisconsin. He's a friend of mine. Our dear Butch, I was fortunate to spend 6 nights and the better part of 7 days in the BWCA, paddling, portaging, and camping with Wilderness Inquiry, a group that brings together abled and disabled. For me, it was a challenging and rewarding experience. I also visited with various good folks in and around Ely, all helpful in my continuing studies of wilderness. Coincidentally, I wrote Chief Robinson on July 10. A copy of my letter is attached. In his testimony, the chief referred to the boundary waters as one of the crown jewels of the National Wilderness Preservation System. And incidentally, since then, I think they gave the boundary waters a special award. You know, there's an award for excellent management. They gave it to the boundary waters. That surely is how we would like to think of it, but it's not the way I found it. The BWCA is badly overused and abused. It is operated as a playground, not protected as a wilderness. It is being loved to death in a recreational orgy rather than being treasured and safeguarded. I would gladly spell out my observations if these would be helpful. Perhaps you already recognize management weaknesses and deficiencies in the boundary waters. If so, I would welcome information on actions you are taking or propose to take to cope with them. I also attach a copy of the first page of a news release from the Wenatchee National Forest regarding another of the crown jewels of the wilderness system. It declares that, and I quote, a Forest Service team is analyzing a wide range of options for dealing with recreational overuse and resource damage within the Alpine Lakes wilderness, unquote. Hopefully, openly identifying the issue and broadcasting the message marked the first steps in dealing with it. With all best, Michael Frum. Never got an answer. Why can't I get an answer? Why doesn't the regional forester want to answer me? What? Ask easier question. You know how it, I'm going to pay you to be my official heckler. You know how it is with some, I don't want to say this, I don't want to get into that kind of, but you can say anything you want about us as long as it's favorable. I don't want to do that. But I want to say that things do get done, and there are wonderful people, and I've been privileged to work with them, and I'm going to do that, continue to do that as long as I'm kicking, and I hope to keep kicking. I got a letter from, individuals are what make the difference. That's what I'm saying. Individuals are what make the difference. Individuals make miracles happen. I got a letter in 1990 from Ariel Lugo. Anybody know him? You know, Ariel Lugo, he's a great tropical ecologist. He works for the Forest Service in Puerto Rico, and he's worked in Florida. Thank you for your words of encouragement. I am very hopeful that after a period of confusion, this agency will wake up and respond to the challenges ahead. At least it is now hiring ecologists, and I don't feel as isolated as I was 10 years ago. I believe that part of the future success or failure in efforts to conserve tropical forests will depend on our ability to influence the organization and performance of agencies such as the Forest Service in each of the tropical countries. What a job! Help from enlightened writers such as yourself will be needed to nudge government in the right direction. Well, I hope so. I've got another letter here that I want to cite from a friend of mine, Angela Evenden. Anybody know Angela? Good. Well, Angela's one of those people who, and Angela, she's the heir of Chuck Wellner. Anybody here know Chuck Wellner? Chuck Wellner established research natural areas in Idaho and elsewhere in the region one, against great odds. He is a saint. And she's going to be a saint too. And a saint never says, I am a saint. A real leader doesn't go around saying, I'm a leader. A leader involves people. A leader is humble. Humility is what makes things really, really happen. And Angela's doing that. I wanted to follow up about building stronger ties between wilderness and other protected areas, including natural areas. Unfortunately, I don't have much written on the topic right now. The enclosed White paper provides the basic framework we are proceeding with. Later this fall, I should have more material to share. At the request of the Washington office, I will be working up a program proposal for linking wilderness and other protected area efforts within the Forest Service, wilderness and research natural areas. Wilderness, more wilderness should be for research natural areas, and research natural areas should be included in the wilderness system. That's my view, and they should be bigger. So if it is favorably received by the powers that be in the Washington office, we may talk about it further with Fento's office, so stay tuned. And there's another great man, I don't know if you know of Bud Heinzelman. Anybody know of Bud Heinzelman? Bud Heinzelman, John knows Bud Heinzelman. He died recently. He's the great champion. He was in research in the Forest Service and the Boundary Waters and did great work. And he left the Forest Service as soon as he could retire to work for the protection of the Boundary Waters. He's a saint too, because he had that great motivation to save something, to create something that would outlast him. So that's my plea to you. Now, before I go and sign off, I want to say two things. First, I brought 12 copies of this book if anybody wants one. I think what I really want to do is I want to give 2 copies for prizes, and if anybody wants to buy the others, you can see me. I'm not sure how much I want to charge for them, somewhere between $8 and $9. And the other thing I want to say is, at our college, we're having a conference on Northwest Media and the Environment. I think there are some people here who deal in public affairs. Are there? I hope so. So we're going to talk about Northwest Media and the Environment. And we have some wonderful speakers, the editor of Seattle Weekly, executive vice president of Weyerhaeuser, the editorial page editor of the Seattle Times, national correspondent of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, Bill Dietrich of the Seattle Times, who wrote The Final Forest, former Governor Dan Evans, Betsy Marston, editor of High Country News, Susan Reed, senior editor of People Magazine, Vic Scherer of the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, and Jack Ward Thomas, who you know. So I have 12 copies of this book, or 10, and I have about 25 copies of this brochure on the conference. So I ought to end up with this. Anybody, how about some more dialogue? We still have 15 minutes. Okay. Sure. I've been watching the clock, so we have some time. The next chief of the Forest Service? Well, I got a good rumor. It's, I don't know whether I gave it to John or got it from John. Well, I just have to tell you, this new administration has been a disappointment to me, real disappointment. They remind me of the Carter administration. They're so busy trying to make points, they can't get anything done, and they're afraid to take a stand on things. I see that in the Interior Department as well. Where they wanted to get a new director of the Park Service, and so they thought it would be Robert Redford. And he turned him down, and then they asked Tom Brokaw, and he turned him down. So they got another guy who's a very fine man of attainment, but that's not what makes things happen. I teach a course in the fall on the history of conservation, and I teach about Gifford Pinchot and Steve Mather and Ding Darling and these great leaders of the past. And I remember one of the chiefs of the Forest Service, I think it was McGuire, he said, if you think I'm going to be another Pinchot, you're crazy. I'd last about 5 minutes. And that's probably true. But what we need is people all throughout the agency who are going to say, this is what I stand for. This is my commitment. We need people who are going to be risk takers. From top to bottom. So, I don't know. Is it going to be Jack Ward Thomas? Is it going to be Jeff Sherman? Is it going to be none of the above? I mean, we can speculate and rumor. The Park Service is better at rumor mongering than the Forest Service, I'll tell you that. Maybe they don't have as much to do. So, go ahead. I never think about that. The greatest risk of, we have, we, first of all, we have to think globally, you know, as we have to, we're all in one world and we have to direct ourselves to global issues and not be narrow, but we have to set, be models in our country. And we have to say to the American people, wilderness is more precious now than it has ever been, and it will become more precious. We can say that population is the biggest issue, and maybe it is. But the fact that we have more people makes wilderness more valuable. And I don't want to see people as a threat. I want to see people as an ally. And the greatest asset we have is to begin to really understand spirituality and ethical caring and to appeal to the spirit in people, and they will respond, I think. And the greatest asset we have, rather than the greatest threat, are caring people, the missionaries. And the greatest missionaries can be you, working with people like, with citizens. Does that make sense?